Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, in for Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Scientists are alarmed and baffled. Over the past few months, songbirds in eastern United States have been dying of a mysterious illness. It affects at least a dozen bird species, and a number of birds killed so far is described as countless. Jennifer Toussaint is the chief of animal control in Arlington, Virginia. She dealt with some of the very first calls of sick and dying birds. Jennifer, thank you for joining us on Point.
Hi, Kim. Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us what it was like. What was the first signs that you saw of something being wrong?
Yeah, so back on May 18th in Arlington, Virginia, we began receiving calls from members of the public that they were finding blue jays and grackles on the ground in their yards in distress. When officers began to respond, we quickly realized that something was amiss. This was atypical injuries, and this was outside of the normal for those species as well.
And what was wrong? What were the signs in these blue jays and grackles that something was wrong?
Yeah, so we were finding them on the ground in good body weight, meaning that parents were still caring for them avidly. When songbirds fledge from the nest, they fall to the ground and spend a period of time on the ground, building up the shoulder strength to fly. So they were in good body weight, but they could not see. We had ocular discharge, crusting around the eyes, and the start of neurological symptoms. They were doing head tics. Some of them had their heads to the ground while standing, a very atypical thing to see in a bird. And they were just obviously unwell.
And so how did you begin to realize that this was a broader problem?
So back on the 18th, one phone call by the end of the day became 15 to 20. That pretty quickly told us that something was amiss. We immediately reached out to state biologists and the state wildlife veterinarian here in Virginia and began speaking with them about some of the issues we were seeing, sending photos, sending videos. And we all quickly determined that this was something that needed to be monitored. Before we knew it, this became more of a full-blown issue throughout the region and lasted now for about 2 months.
So we have seen diseases affect birds before in the past, in past years. What is different about this particular illness? And talk about how you came to realize that this was something different.
Absolutely. So I've experienced issues with West Nile, for instance, showing signs and symptoms in birds. I've never experienced the volume of ill patients coming in and the volume of what appeared to be relatively decently healthy songbirds found deceased in yards. Again, with these ocular issues, the discharge, the crusting, and general blindness. And additionally, it kind of snowballed really quickly. Normally at the start of an illness, you get kind of a slow increase to a peak. And this kind of felt like it onset overnight.
And sort of describe, I mean, you've been at ALA for a long time. You've worked with animals and cared for them. What was it like realizing, oh my goodness, this is something that is affecting birds here. This could be something very serious.
Yeah, so within about 3 or 4 days, all of the rehabbers who specialize in treating migratory birds and very advanced wildlife centers became overrun with these patients. The birds were not responding to stereotypical medications that would be provided for things like finch conjunctivitis and other eye issues that can crop up in birds. And so those professionals, the rehabbers and centers, began declining patients. So they were suggesting that the birds were euthanized on intake. That doesn't seem like that big of an issue, except for when you're suddenly dealing with 20 birds a day coming in. We immediately realized that that this was going to be a heartbreaking event.
So talk about those decisions, I mean, that you have to make. You are, and people may not realize the work that you and others do to often treat birds, try to figure out what's going on, treat them so that they can be returned to the wild. But this was very different.
Correct. Yeah. So standard patients coming in this time of year for birds, you know, we get little guys that get themselves into trouble. They're very successful in rehab and they can be re-released. Again, conservation is our number one goal. So when you're going from that kind of role to suddenly having to euthanize 5 or 6 birds at a time, it immediately feels devastating, not only as an agency, but as an officer.
So is there any indication of what might be causing this, Jennifer? I know some people have theorized that it has to do with the cicadas that descended upon this region this year. Do you have any, and we'll talk more about that later as well, but do you have any indication of what might be causing this? Is this spread from bird to bird? Is there another cause?
Yeah, so we're still trying to figure all of that out. We are still sending out things for testing as recently as 2 days ago, staying in contact with all the national organizations who are now lending a hand to the region and state in trying to determine through concrete scientific testing what this issue was. The good thing is we know what it isn't. We've ruled out a lot of the more, I would say, scary illnesses that are zoonotic or transferable to people. Mm-hmm. We've ruled out some of the players that a lot of people had speculated it was at the start. I will say we saw the onset very similarly to the start of cicadas in our region, and we are starting to see drop-offs in patients coming in, and cicadas mm-hmm. are starting to lessen in our region. But I think we know that we can never assume that because something happened concurrently, that there is that inherent connection. I know that a lot of agencies are very determined in finding out why this occurred.
Yeah, so we've gotten a lot of responses from our listeners to the show. Amy called us from Greenfield, Massachusetts, and she's said that we need to be more thoughtful when using pesticides.
Anyone who is responsible for landscaping, who has a decision-making role in what happens on their own property, their commercial property, municipal property, etc., can make wise choices about the use of herbicides and pesticides, and looking at what the impact is on birds and, in fact, other pollinators, since bees are in trouble too, as we know.
Jennifer, in your experience, could pesticides be one of the issues at play here?
Yeah, so as you mentioned at the start of the program today, there are a lot of things affecting birds, and we are seeing national decreases. And you know, birds are federally protected for a reason. They are a national treasure. And when they spend their part of the year with each of us, because a lot of them kind of move through our areas, it is really our responsibility to take care of them. So things like not spraying pesticides, ensuring you're appropriately cleaning your bird feeders regularly, because bird feeders can be a way that birds spread illnesses to each other. It has not been definitively connected to this incident, but we did put that messaging out right away. Please take down bird feeders and clean out and clear mm-hmm. bird baths. There's lots of ways that we can individually foster and help our bird population.
And talk a little bit more about that, because I don't, that this is something I was unaware about in my house. We were considering getting a bird feeder, and I'm learning a lot about this show. People want to feed birds, birds eat the food. What is it about bird feeders that can be dangerous?
Yeah, so bird feeders, they do come. A lot of different species of birds come to the feeders to feed. There are certain times of years where the birds need the feeders maybe more than others. It's a great pastime as well. It's a great way to enjoy such a lovely national resource, watching the birds and engaging with your children. Bird feeders need to be cleaned weekly. A lot of people, unfortunately, get in the habit of rushing out there when it's empty and just refilling it rather than taking it down and thoroughly sanitizing it before refilling, letting it completely dry. A really important part to ensure that you don't get any bacteria, fungus growth, et cetera, and then rehanging it. And if you are feeding hummingbirds, you need to be doing it multiple times a week.
Yeah. So what can people do if they are concerned about this? And, you know, we all love birds. They're a part of nature. You know, love songs are written about birds singing in the sky when you're in love. What can people do to protect birds? And do you, they're doing your work in Arlington, Virginia, do you have the resources you need to do what you do?
Yeah, so there are lots of ways as an individual you can support the birds. Again, going back to speaking with your local HOA about not using pesticides, speaking to neighbors about how to do humane deterrence and not to destroy or cut down trees at certain times of the year when they're being so avidly used by our birds and our other native wildlife. You know, baby season is commonly the spring, and that's always when I see people calling out companies to remove trees and cut down things which are a vital resource to the wildlife at that time. As an officer, I'm very lucky. I work for an organization that really supports wildlife in a holistic way. We take the One Health perspective, like many animal welfare organizations, of understanding the connectivity between people, pets, the environment, wildlife, and our overall health. So yes, I have lots of access to resources, but maybe your local animal control agency, wherever the listener is, that officer doesn't have the resources they might need. So reaching out to your animal welfare experts in your area and saying, hey, how can I lend a hand?
So what comes next for you, Jennifer? What are you looking out for now? You're saying you're seeing the intake of these birds drop down. Do you think we're on the other side of this, or what do you think happens next?
Yes, I'm amazingly optimistic that this is coming to a conclusion in our region. I will say it has not concluded yet. We received 3 reports yesterday of deceased birds in yards and already 2 this morning, but actually intakes of patients showing these signs and symptoms, we have not gotten one into the organization in the last week. So that's a huge difference, right, of 20 a week.
Yeah. Well, Jennifer Toussaint is the chief of animal control in Arlington, Virginia. Jennifer, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Kim.
We're talking about birds and the mysterious disease that's been causing the death of songbirds. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Today we're talking about birds, about the mysterious illness that has been killing songbirds in a handful of eastern and midwestern states. Joining me now is Margaret Brittingham. She's a professor of wildlife resources at Penn State University. Margaret, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for inviting me.
And also we're joined by Peter Mera. He's director of the Environment Initiative and professor of biology at the Environment and the Environment at Georgetown University. He co-edited the book Birds of Two Worlds, The Ecology and Evolution of Migration. Peter, welcome to you too.
Hello.
So I want to get a sense. We listened a little bit about what is happening to these bird populations here in the Washington, D.C. area where I am. I want to get a broader sense of what is happening here. Margaret, what are you seeing in the broader population when it comes to these songbirds facing this mystery illness?
Well, certainly, you know, as Jennifer said, the disease or the illness, whatever it is, was first noted in Washington. And at this point, it's been reported in about 10 states. And here in Pennsylvania, we started getting reports probably in the mid-June to later June. So we were on the later side of it. But again, through about across about half the state. So definitely fairly widespread and definitely of concern. There are a number of organizations, as Jennifer said, there are a number of organizations working on this, the U.S. GS Health Lab in Madison, Wisconsin, and then we have a lab here in Pennsylvania working on it, and also one in Georgia, really trying to sort out what the cause of this is.
And Margaret, what in those labs, what testing is going on? What does that look like?
Well, what they've done is they first looked at, as Jennifer said, some of the things that have commonly affected birds. So salmonella was one. Last winter, there was a big salmonella outbreak in pine siskins. And so that was one that came up right away. West Nile is another one. And West Nile is a really important disease that, you know, affecting birds across the country and a very important one. But anyway, it wasn't West Nile, wasn't Newcastle virus. So they tested a lot of the things that it wasn't the conjunctivitis that we've seen in house finches. So looking at a lot of the diseases that we've seen in the past, it's a complicated because you're getting, you know, all these different birds from different places and you've got to figure out what they've got, but then you've also got to show that that's the cause of what, you know, of what these problems are. So it's complicated.
Yeah. So Peter, sort of explain to us, give us a perspective of how this is like or different from past bird diseases that we saw, where we saw the decline in these populations, and what about this makes it so significant?
Yeah. So, you know, we've been here before, unfortunately. This is yet just another shot across our bow of the sorts of impacts that we're seeing birds facing. In 1999, we started seeing dead birds, mainly crows, early on around the Bronx Zoo, in fact. And there happened to be pathologists there that noticed the high mortality of dead crows and determined that it was a new invasive disease of transmitted by a mosquito. It was West Nile virus, and that soon spread throughout the U.S. in the Western Hemisphere. Avian influenza is another. So anytime you start seeing dead birds, they are, of course, the canary in the coal mine, or in this case, the sparrows and grackles on the streets that are telling us there's something out there that's not quite right. It's something that's could be turning into an unraveling of our important bird communities. And so it's really critical that we start to figure out not just what it is, but how significant is it? We really don't know yet how significant the mortality is. Is it really mortality that is reducing the overall populations, or is it not quite that significant? It's primarily fledglings. It's not it's not having an impact on adults, we don't think. So my hope is that it's not quite that significant, not as significant as West Nile virus. But we still need to figure out what it is.
So, Peter, and on that note, can you explain sort of the universe of possibilities, right? What might it be if it's not that significant? Are there just fluctuations in bird populations over the years in a natural way? And go to the other end of the spectrum, could this be perhaps some new disease that scientists and ornithologists have not yet figured out?
Well, you know, it could be any assortment of things. It's since the symptoms seem to be fairly similar across a larger geographic spread, it's likely some sort of, you know, it's something similar across these different areas from Texas to Virginia to other parts in the East Coast. So it's probably the same thing, but it's really not clear what it is. It's obviously being transmitted, so it's spreading somehow, and spreading somewhat fast, or it's being exposed and being made available somehow. So it's really not clear what it is. I don't want to guess, but I know that the folks at USGS are doing a wonderful job of testing everything possible. So, you know, that being said, we also know that bird populations are declining drastically due to a whole suite of things that are both direct, like something like a disease causing direct mortality, to indirect factors like habitat loss. And, you know, it's this complicated suite of things that are impacting bird populations, and it's often difficult to assign what those actual causes are.
And Margaret, I want to throw out a potential cause. One thing that this has coincided with, at least here in the DC area, were the cicadas. I have to say that for a while, every morning I'd go out and on our porch, there were cicada wings that were like what was left over from an evening of birds eating them. Is this a potential cause for what we're seeing?
Well, certainly on the internet, cicadas have been brought up as one of the popular causes. And certainly there's been a geographic and temporal overlap, you know, that the disease birds have been in areas where we did have the 17-year cicadas, and it has overlapped in terms of time and space. So, you know, the thought is, and birds feed on cicadas. And as you said, they tear off the wings and then they will feed them and they'll feed them to their young. Now, so if there is something associated with the cicadas, the young would get a super concentrated amount of it because they are so small. I will say that the entomologists do not really think this is related, you know, because they say we've got 15-year cicadas, we've got 13-year cicadas, we've got, you know, so this has never happened before. So if it is cicadas, it's something different than we've seen in the past, because we, you know, even though the 17 has been kind of, you know, it's the 17-year ones, we also have 15-year cicadas, we also have 13-year cicadas, we have, you know, whole different ones. And this is not occurred at any other time. And because it's happening, you know, sort of with our backyard birds, I think probably if it had occurred before, we would have known it. But that's not to say that something, you know, that something different may have happened. The idea that's been proposed is there's a fungus associated with the cicadas, and whether, you know, more of them are infected than in the past, and then birds are getting more of it. That's kind of the relationship.
Right. Well, Peter, we've heard here in Washington about a fungal infection that affected part of the cicada population, where you could actually see the fungus on some of them. Could that be a link?
It certainly was an initial hypothesis, and I'm pretty confident that the folks at National Wildlife Health Center probably did some assays looking for the presence of the fungus in the birds. Of course, you need to recognize that just the presence of the fungus in the birds may not be the cause of mortality. That's, you know, drawing that linkage, as Margaret said before, is a tricky thing. The other piece of evidence that's really important in eliminating the cicada hypothesis is the fact that the mortality extends beyond areas into areas where there are no cicadas. Into areas like Texas, and birds that are being found dead in these other places have these same symptoms where there just are no cicadas. So we can use the power of space and time to sort of look at this question and eliminate the cicada idea, which makes it even trickier.
So let's take a step back and talk a little bit more broadly about why this is important, why the decline in these populations of birds are so important. What are the implications for us as humans, not just in our enjoyment of them, but for the environment, Margaret?
Well, you know, as you said, we start with sort of our enjoyment of birds, but a bigger thing than that is that birds have been used as that canary in the coal mine, as indicators of what's, you know, changes that are occurring and factors that are affecting other parts of our ecosystem and us. One of the things that have made birds such wonderful indicators is that we have so many different species, and many of them very specialized to certain types of feeding behavior or habitats. And then we have a lot of data on birds because they're visible, they're easy to identify, and we have this huge group of citizen scientists out there, you know, birders, everything from backyards to other ones, collecting information on them. So we know a lot about them. We can see when these changes occur, and then many of the changes that occurred are linked back to something that may be affecting all of us. And probably, you know, the best example would be DDT, you know, where that it was the decline in peregrine falcon and bald eagle and osprey that were indicators of problems with DDT. And DDT, it wasn't just that they were affecting them, it was all the way through the ecosystem and including people. So there are indicators. So that's one big thing. They're such wonderful and great indicators of all of these different changes that are occurring. And then the other big part of it is that birds are providing all kinds of ecological services to us for free. Everything from, you know, control of insect pests to regenerating the forest to cleaning, you know, to the vulture who's cleaning the dead raccoon on the side of the road. So great ecological services also.
So what are these indicators, Peter? What are the indicators telling you about what this illness represents as far as our environment?
Sure. And so, you know, this illness that we're trying to figure out right now is one of many, right? And so there's West Nile virus, there's avian influenza, but there's lots of other threats that are impacting birds. And we published a paper just 2 years ago in 2019 that reported a decline of around 3 billion birds, about a third of our overall avifaunal abundance, and 57% of species are declining. What that represents is an unraveling of our ecosystem, an ecosystem that we are a part of, an ecosystem that we depend on just like birds. So, you know, as Margaret said, as I've said, birds are canaries in the coal mine that are warning signals, not just about the birds, but also to us as humans, as co-inhabitants of the earth. And so it is our responsibility to protect the planet and protect these ecosystems, not just for birds, but for future generations. It's critical. It's our responsibility.
Margaret, could climate change be playing a role here?
Certainly it could be playing a role. I mean, we've seen with many diseases that they become more prevalent or more active, you know, because of changes in the climate. So everything like West Nile is an example where certainly warmer winters make that a more prevalent disease. So certainly it is. I mean, climate change, I think, is affecting everything in terms of what can persist over winter and for longer periods of time. But I don't think we have any idea at this point what those linkages are. I mean, I think we've got to kind of get back to sort of having some more solid idea of what it is, and then we can kind of go back and look at those bigger questions of climate change. But certainly climate change has been making all sorts of changes, you know, all through the ecosystem.
Yeah. And Peter, do we know whether this is a North American phenomenon, or are we seeing similar things in other parts of the world?
You mean with the disease in particular, or declines
yes,
of birds?
Well, both.
Well, so with this disease, it's funny you should ask. Just yesterday, I had somebody write me from South Korea telling me that they were seeing similar symptoms in birds there. So I think it's important that we start to communicate more broadly about the symptoms. And I'm guessing that USGS, the National Wildlife Health Center, they are doing that, in fact. But we should start looking further at other patterns of avian mortality. Regarding declines of birds globally, unfortunately, we are seeing these same exact things globally. And it's because of humans. It's because of what we're doing to habitats. We're destroying habitats at an alarming rate. These are habitats that birds depend upon. We are, you know, climate change is, as Margaret said, is a challenging thing to really understand in terms of how it's impacting birds, but it undoubtedly is and undoubtedly will in the future. We're also doing a lot of other things that are impacting bird populations, like cats. Cats outdoors are responsible in the U.S. for 1.3 to 4 billion bird deaths a year, which is significant. Cats have caused and contributed to the extinction of 63 species on the planet, not just on islands, but also on mainlands. 40 of those are bird species. Buildings also are responsible for killing lots and lots of birds, 500 million plus a year in the U.S. alone. And then there's pesticides, things like neonicotinoids, which are, again, like a disease. It's sort of this thing that it's hard to put a finger on because you don't often find dead birds. We're seeing these dead birds around our houses because we're there. And they die on a street, or a fledgling can't really fly away and hide and die in a place where we don't find it. But there may be a lot more mortality where there aren't a lot of people, in woods and things, where they're picked up by scavengers and other animals. So understanding the true mortality of something like a pesticide or a disease is really a challenging thing to do.
All right, we are going to have Margaret Brittingham and Peter Mara hold for just a moment and stay with us. We are discussing birds, the mystery around the death of songbirds these past few weeks and months, and the overall health of our bird population. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. We're talking this hour about birds, a recent mysterious disease that's been killing them, their declining populations, and also the joy that we can find in experiencing them. I'm joined by Margaret Brittingham, an avian ecologist at Penn State University. Also with me is Peter Mara, professor of biology and the environment at Georgetown University. I'd like to take a moment to focus on this idea of joy, the joy that might come if we take time to listen and to look. We reached out to Julie Zicafuz for some words of advice on that front. She's a writer, an artist, a bird rehabber, and naturalist.
No matter where you live, there are going to be birds around you. They're everywhere. They're in urban areas. I mean, they're peregrine falcons nesting on buildings in downtown cities. And I've been walking in cities and heard the kick of a peregrine coming from the top of a building, and people are just going by on the street completely unaware that this amazing bird is sitting up there on a cornice yelling.
Julie lives and works on 80 acres in the Appalachian foothills of southeastern Ohio. Every morning she walks through the meadows, the orchards, and the forests on her property.
The morning walk is definitely, I call it my morning practice, because it's, and I'll often say, you know, I'm going out to get my mind straight.
Julie says every time she's out walking and birding, the world shows her something to be amazed about, a new nesting pair of orchard orioles, a familiar blue-winged warbler, a whippoorwill.
When I go on my walk in the morning, this time of year, in heavy, heavy high summer, I tend to stick to the meadow where I've mown a couple of miles of trails through it. And then I go into the wooded orchard and I bird there and I see who's feeding young and I listen to the swelling cicada chorus, which just started today, the dog day cicadas, not the periodic ones. So it's really very beautiful, and I make it a point to do this every single day. And then I can be in touch with the changes and the phenology of the season. What's happening on a given day might be very different from what was happening the day before. I do have actually lots of favorite places. One is my husband's grave, which is out in the middle of the meadow, and he's only been gone a couple of years. And it seems like I always see or hear something really neat out there, and I often think it's a message from him. After I visit Bill, I walk into the orchard, and there's a tree there I call the Dogwood God, which is this enormous Virginia dogwood that I cleared of overhanging vines and strangling multiflora rose. And I love to stand there and just revel in this amazing tree, holding forth there with a clear understory. And I like to listen to what's singing there, and sometimes I even climb up in it for a whole different perspective on the woods. I can be gone anywhere from an hour to 3 or 4 hours, depending on what I find. And that's the beauty of it. It's my daily practice is led by exploration and discovery. And let's say I find something cool like a nursery web spider, and I want to photograph the spider tending its young, you know, that kind of thing. It just depends. Or maybe like today I ran into the brood of blue-winged warblers being fed. And before that, I had a great look at a yellow-billed cuckoo calling, which is a bird that's really hard to get a look at. I study what I've got, I love what I've got, and I'm happy with what I can see. Birds have these beautiful songs that, if we allow them to, can seep into our consciousness and shape an experience for us. Like, there's nothing like going out on a summer evening and listening to the first whippoorwill start to sing, and then joined by a barred owl or a woodcock twirling in the sky. There's just something about the fact that they're songsters and they're migrants and they fly and they spend some time with us, but then they go away on these mysterious odysseys that are so much more amazing than we ever dreamt. So I just think that's why birds, you know, that's all quite outside of their incredible beauty and their intelligence and their vibrancy. I think Roger Torrey Peterson called them the most eloquent or vibrant expression of life on Earth. And I tend to agree.
Julie Zicafus is a writer, artist, bird rehabber, and naturalist. She lives, walks, and birds on her 80 acres in southeastern Ohio. To find a link to Julie's books and artwork, just head to onpointradio.org. Now, Peter, I want to turn to you. What about this? Not everyone has 80 acres of land to wander through as a sanctuary, but can Julie's morning walk, what can that teach us about paying attention to our environment?
Yeah, I mean, Julie's one of my favorite people on the planet, and she interprets natural history as I feel it, and she describes it how she feels it in a way like very few people can. She, when she talks, she paints this picture, and that picture is a Monet, it's a Rembrandt, it's a Picasso. And the way I think of it is, I think of every bird as a piece of art. In the same way that we hang pictures on the walls in museums, I wish more people would think of birds when they walk out their door as live, breathing, flying pieces of art, because that's what they are. And what's so sad to me, and what's really, really hard to take, and what I refuse to let happen, is that we're losing our Rembrandts and our Picassos and our Monets and our Homers right before our eyes. And so people need to, I wish people would get out and appreciate these pieces of art just like they do in a museum, or they do listening to an incredible piece of music, because these are pieces of natural history, of our history, that we have to protect for future generations.
So, Margaret, we're hearing a lot from our listeners, and one listener comment on Facebook from Bill Sell says, I'm a cat lover and am concerned about the fact that cats are dangerous to birds. Cats are predators and will catch birds even if they're not hungry. Letting the cat out is thought to be a normal part of living with cats, but it's not harmless. Margaret, we heard a little bit about this earlier from Peter. What do you say to Bill?
Well, I mean, Peter's work has shown very clearly what effect, you know, cats can have on birds. They're incredible predators, and they'll prey on cats, on birds, even when they're not hungry. So the best thing for both the birds and the cats are to keep them indoors. And outdoor cats are a problem. And even for the health of the cats, it's not good. So, I mean, I'd say if you are a cat lover, and I like cats, I mean, is to keep them indoors.
And we got a call from Lily from Somerville, Massachusetts. She says she's been interested in birds since she was a child, but it wasn't until she moved to rural Maine during the pandemic when she really fell in love.
That was finally a moment where I was sitting in the backyard on my computer working, but also had my binoculars and started really studying birds and figuring out who was saying what, who was doing what, who liked to nest where, who was eating, who was out in the morning and in the afternoon, who liked the water as it came in, and who liked when it was low tide. And I just absolutely fell in love with the world of birds and with the natural world. And I think that birds give us a window to a world that is so expansive and beautiful and wonderful, but is being destroyed. And I think that if more people could fall in love with birds, we could be making more change.
So, Peter, I want to focus on that love a little bit more. And for you, tell us what made you want to go into this work. Do you have a story that's similar to that?
I do. I was around 6 years old, and I was a free-range child. I'm 58, so that would have been around the late 1960s. But I was a free-range child. I went where I wanted to go, and I was lucky enough to have a nature center nearby. And in my opinion, we don't have enough nature centers in the world for all the children that we want to teach about nature. And so I was there one day, and there happened to be a naturalist. This was the Westport Nature Center. And there happened to be a naturalist there misnetting birds. And that naturalist showed me that bird. He exposed me to that nature. I looked into the eyes of a black-capped chickadee, and it lit a fire in me that never went out. And I have always been one of these fortunate people that has always been passionate about and always known what I wanted to do. I always wanted to study nature and protect our environment and birds.
And what about you, Margaret? What made you, what spurred your interest in birds?
These are such wonderful stories. I was a little bit different. I always loved the outdoors, and I was I spent lots of time camping and hiking and all of that. And then in college, I took a wildflower course, and it was the wildflower course that made me realize I can't believe all this is happening around me. You know, seeing Dutchman's breeches and trillium and hepatica, and all of a sudden I realized the wonders, you know, of spring phenology and what was going on. And then I was sort of searching for where my place was. I was always science oriented and animal oriented and nature oriented. And I worked in a lab with some, and there were birders there, and they introduced me to birds. And I remember January 1st, it was a northern flicker that came to my window, and I looked at that bird, and I was like, oh my God, that's the most incredible thing I've ever seen. And that was my spark bird. And then I said, I'm going to study birds. And I mean, I was already out of college. And so I then went back and got did another year, and then went on to graduate school. So I'm an example of a later convert, but I've just, you know, it was once I got bitten by that bug, I couldn't stop. And it was like I was doing what I would have done from the very beginning if I'd only known about it. And so I think that's what's so important about introducing people, exposing people, and just as Pete said, to get, you know, people out at nature centers, to get, you know, kids involved. And you can do it at any time and any age, but once people get just that tiny spark, they take off on it on their own. And it makes every season your favorite season, because there's always changes coming. You know, you can, you know, we're getting ready now for the shorebird migration and then the fall warblers. And it's just every season can be your best season. Winter, and you get this, the winter finches, and where we have evening mm-hmm. grosbeaks. And so it's just, it's incredible.
Oh, another listener, Chris, called us from Seattle, Washington, and left this message.
My house is a habitat. Our yard is a habitat. So there have been increased birds to the property, and it's really exciting to see them. Hummingbirds are my favorite. What I'm concerned about is, despite that, that decrease is also the insatiable appetite for us to create space for humans at the risk of decreasing space for birds.
So, Peter, speak to that, the quest for human habitat being in conflict with bird habitats.
Yeah, Chris brings up a really important point, and it's something I'm now devoting my life to, and that is to figure out how we can live more sustainably and protect wildlife like birds at the same time. And one of those big drivers is food and our production of food. As we plow a field and we plant corn, or we plant wheat, or we drink our morning coffee, there are ways to think about these things. There are ways to grow these sorts of things so we minimize our impact. Coffee is a perfect example. The Smithsonian Migratory Bird Center, where I was before moving to Georgetown, created a certification so people can buy coffee off the shelf and buy coffee that's actually grown in a rich, tall, canopied forest. So they can actually drink their coffee, get their caffeine and rich, delicious coffee flavor, and still protect birds at the same time. We need to move more towards those sorts of resources that are things that are grown or produced in a way that are minimally impacting wildlife.
And Margaret, talk more about that. What can people do? I didn't know about that, and I love coffee, so I'm definitely going to do that. What can people do to help the natural habitat of these birds?
Well, I think a lot of what people can do is change your perspective of what you want your yard or your community park to look like. So kind of, you know, getting a different perspective. We've kind of come from a European sort of lawn and ornamental tree kind of background, but there's no reason to have these acres and acres and acres of trees. And one of the people I'm a big fan of is Doug Talamay, who's a researcher at University of Delaware. He's an entomologist, and he's written a book, Nature's Best Hope. And it's really that all of us can make a big difference just within our own backyards by landscaping with native plants. You know, get rid of the Bradford pear, get rid of the, you know, just use native plants, and native plants support native insects, which support native birds, and on up. And it's just a change of perspective, and reduce the amount of lawn that you have. You know, what do you need your lawn for? You might want to have a volleyball net or whatever, but you don't need to have acres and acres of it. And so changing our perspective about what looks good. And certainly community parks, and in our area, community parks are making a big effort at that, where we've got, you know, now we've got pollinator gardens, and we have signs up that explain, you know, the reason this isn't mowed is this is a meadow, and you know, the different kinds of things you're going to see within the meadow. So I think it's, I think there is a lot that people can do, and I think that we can coexist a lot better than we have been doing, so that it's not birds or people, but it's how can we all coexist together. And certainly, you know, the interest in insects and pollinators is also bringing that together.
And Peter, the last word goes to you. What can people do besides the coffee?
Yeah, there's all those local things, like planting native plants, like keeping cats indoors, like minimizing the impact that your windows might have. And I would say the last thing that they should do is also support groups like the American Bird Conservancy and their local nature centers. I think that those dollars will go a long way.
All right. Peter Mara is director of the Environment Initiative and professor at Georgetown University. Peter, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And Margaret Brittingham is a professor of wildlife resources at Penn State University. Margaret, thank you so much.
Thank you, Kim.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast on our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.